From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Vigorous lava eruptions continue today from the Kilauea volcano on Hawaii's Big Island. Lava is spewing from fissures in the Leilani Estates and Lanapuna Gardens areas. Thousands have had to evacuate their homes, and lava has destroyed more than 80 structures. Meanwhile, ash continues to spew from a vent at Kilauea's summit. NPR's Nathan Rott is on the Big Island and joins us now. Nathan, what is the greatest concern for officials at this point?
Well, from a human standpoint, the biggest concerns are, you know, people's homes and safety, obviously. These lava flows keep spewing and in some cases gushing from a lot of these fissures. Two nights ago, there were some evacuations because because a pool of lava had overspilled its banks, causing some of it to rush, you know, downhill into some areas that it hadn't been previously. The area directly impacted by that lava, though, we should say, is pretty small relative to the size of this island. The broader concern is air quality. There's ash and fog, this volcanic fog that can be bad for people's respiratory systems, that's also coming off of the volcano. And there's, you know, looking at my window here, there's a fair amount of it that's settled into Hilo, where I am today. It kind of looks like, you know, Montana or California in wildfire season with the smoke just settling in the valley or wherever.
Well, we're hearing that the fog has even reached Guam.
Yeah, no, it's been drifting. The trade winds have been pushing it west primarily for the last few weeks, but then those winds have died down actually over the last couple of days. So it's starting to drift a little more east and north to these parts.
One of the concerns, we've talked about it, is that there is a geothermal plant near the lava flow. What are the concerns there?
Well, outside of the lost power generation, which is, you know, significant for this island, the bigger concern has been with these geothermal wells at the site. There were concerns that if lava overran them, it could release hydrogen sulfide, a deadly gas. You know, the lava has already covered a couple of these wells, and there has been no release of that gas that they've detected. I talked to an academic who works on geothermal the other day, and she said, you know, the odds of a hydrogen sulfide release are actually very, very low. But still, you know, they want to make sure that they have that area clear so that it doesn't have an impact on folks.
You've been talking to people there. What are they feeling at this point? This has been going on for some time now.
Yeah, almost a month. You know, it's hard because there's just so much uncertainty with an event like this. You know, it's not like a wildfire or a tornado or hurricane where, you know, the disaster happens and then it's over. This volcano could be erupting for months. You know, a similar eruption lasted for almost 3 months in 1955. Geologists I've talked to, you know, they really do not know when this is going to end. They're studying it, you know, excitedly studying it because it's a really cool scientific opportunity to better learn how this sort of system works. But, you know, they don't really have a good answer for that. And so, you know, to give you an idea of the human impact of that, I've talked to people here who have had lava come within 100 yards of their house and stop, and then it moves a little closer a couple days later, and then it stops again. And so imagine just going through that on and on and on, feeling like you dodged a bullet only to find out a little while later that you didn't.
Pretty nerve-wracking. And I'm sure that there is a lot of worry as well. In the tourism industry in Hawaii, this is a state that depends very heavily on tourism. How has it been impacted by all these pictures of lava, you know, flowing uncontrollably on the Big Island?
Yeah, there's been a really big impact. Bookings are down 50%, according to tourism authorities here. And, you know, this is a economy that is hugely dependent on tourism, and that's causing a lot of frustration because people here feel like there's been a sensationalization of the eruption. I talked to a woman, Diane Lay, who works for the County of Hawaii. Let's hear a little of that from her here.
When some of the headlines are a little bit dramatic, you know, like Kilauea explodes, you know, I think that not only, you know, discourages and frightens visitors and potential visitors, but also our residents. I mean, just angst. It raises the level of angst.
I mean, what they want you to know here, and I think it is important to remember this, that, you know, the Big Island is called the Big Island for a reason.
Right.
You know, there are a lot of places I've been where you wouldn't even know that a volcano is erupting. So I know from a lot of folks here that I've talked to that there's a worry and a concern, and what people don't want to have is this natural disaster lead to a longer, larger economic one.
It's NPR's Nathan Rott joining us from the Big Island of Hawaii. Nathan, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Earlier this year, President Trump announced a new anti-drug advertising campaign to combat the opioid crisis. This isn't the first time we've seen anti-drug ads. First Lady Nancy Reagan championed Just Say No, and in the 80s and 90s, we also saw ads that featured eggs in a frying pan.
Okay, last time. This is drugs. This is your brain on drugs. Any questions?
But did those ads work? Well, Keith Humphreys is a professor of psychiatry at Stanford University and former senior policy advisor for the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy under Presidents Bush and Obama. And Professor, can you tell us about these ads from the 80s and 90s?
Well, they were a mix of scare tactics and your father waving his finger in your face and telling you what to do. And that made them very popular with Congress, but they did not resonate with their target audience, who are, after all, young people.
Yeah, I mean, to be perfectly transparent, I was a teenager during the This Is Your Brain on Drugs campaign, and everyone I know of a certain age basically laughed, and it became, I mean, if we had a 90s version of a meme, that would have been a meme in the 90s. It was that ineffective.
No, and it's absolutely true. And, you know, this is where you get into sort of the political economy problem of, you know, if you get $1 billion from Congress, you want something that makes them happy, that they think is good, but you're not really aiming ads at a population that is, you know, averages about 60 years old and wears a business suit every day. You're looking for young people who are way hipper, more concerned about their autonomy, and also way more ethnically and culturally diverse than your congressional stakeholders are. And if you don't take that into account, you end up with ads that are laughed at and, in fact, sometimes may even backfire.
I mean, obviously, my one-person anecdote about the 80s and 90s ineffectiveness, it does not suffice. I mean, have there been studies that have done that have shown whether or not they even made a dent in terms of drug use back then?
Anti-drug commercials have actually been studied extensively, both in the U.S. as well as in a number of other countries that have tried them. And the modal finding is that they make no difference at all, with the exception that occasionally, at least some kids who see more of these ads actually say they're more interested in trying drugs, that there's something about the ads that either glamorize drugs to them or maybe set off the young rebel in them that they actually want to do the opposite of what the ads are telling them to do.
Oh, interesting. But on the other hand, in around the year 2000, there was a major anti-tobacco campaign launched that's called Truth. They took a different tack. Was that more successful?
Yeah, the Truth campaign was a great improvement on both prior tobacco campaigns as well as on anything that's been done with illicit drugs. And they started with the mind of the audience, which was, you know, mainly adolescents is who you're trying to stop from taking up smoking. And rather than sort of tell them what to do, which no adolescent likes to be told what to do, they said, you know who's trying to order you around? The tobacco companies. And they had these terrific ads with a lot of people who, you know, maybe looked like your boring old parents saying, we're going to addict these kids. These kids are dummies. We're going to make them use our product, take their money, and destroy their health. And then the rebels in the ads, the cool kids who could not be ordered around, were the ones who said, no to you, tobacco companies. We're not going to smoke. You can't make fools of us. And that campaign resonated with young people and is credited with stopping hundreds of thousands of kids from taking up smoking.
Mm. We've got a little bit of one of those ads here, so let's listen.
Tobacco companies sell a product that kills their customers. But without their customers, they go out of business. So every day they need to attract what one tobacco exec called, quote, replacement smokers.
My dad died from emphysema from smoking 6 years ago. I haven't met his replacement yet.
But I wonder, I mean, you were at the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy under two presidents, President Bush and President Obama. It seems as if there are possibly other areas where this money could be used that would they lead to a greater effectiveness in curbing the opioid epidemic?
That's a very important point. We do know a lot about prevention that is very effective with kids and with families. We have terrific evidence-based programs. One is called Communities That Care. And those are programs that bring families together, give kids fun opportunities to interact in their community, to connect with each other, to have richer and more fulfilling lives. And some of that focuses on substance use, but a lot of it doesn't. A lot of the game is making life more enjoyable without drugs.
But it does seem that the president's overall opioid initiative may do some of those things, right? If not directly trying to come up with programs that shift families and kids, young people's attention away from opioid use, then perhaps, you know, just reducing the overall availability, right? Because I'm just curious what you think about the president's idea to cut the number of opioid prescriptions by a third in a couple of years.
The United States consumes more opioids than any country in the world. And if we cut our consumption by 40%, we would still consume more than any country in the world. Other countries, developed countries like in Europe that have a comparable level of pain as the United States, consume about a sixth or an eighth of the amount of opioids per capita. So that's certainly, you know, a smart thing to look at about training doctors differently, perhaps also constraining the pharmaceutical industry's ability to promote these products as aggressively as they do. Mm.
Well, Keith Humphreys is a professor of psychiatry at the Stanford University School of Medicine. He also served as senior policy advisor for the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy under both President Bush and President Obama. Professor Humphreys, thank you so very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
The last planned search for the missing Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 wraps up today. That flight carrying 239 people vanished in March of 2014 on its way from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing. The private Texas-based company Ocean Infinity has been searching the ocean floor since January of this year after the official search paid for by Australia ended last year. Richard Quest is international business correspondent at CNN and host of Quest Means Business. His book is called The Vanishing of Flight MH370, The True Story of the Hunt for the Missing Malaysian Plane. Richard Quest, welcome back.
Lovely to be with you. An extraordinary way in which this story, this MH370, just doesn't end.
Well, that's right. I mean, we still don't know what happened to this plane. Did we learn anything from the searches that have been going on?
Not really. I mean, I suppose one can extrapolate. We learned what the bottom of the ocean looks like. We learned some of the debris that is down there. Did we, from this latest search by Ocean Infinity, learn anything else? Not really, and it's most disappointing, and it's rather worrying in a sense, because not only did they search the tens of thousands of square kilometers that were thought to be most likely, because of their sophisticated searching techniques, they searched even more. They searched over 100,000 square kilometers, and they still didn't find anything. Now, having had the original search 2 years ago, which came up with nothing, but then refined the limited data they had, and then added in the reverse drift techniques from the debris that had washed up in Africa, they were pretty certain that they had a good handle on where it was in a zone just slightly north of the previous search area. Well, it's not.
When you say reverse drift techniques, tell us about some of the technology that they were able to use that the Australians were not.
What they did was they took the debris, and I mean, the Australians were very much involved in this, by the way. Don't forget, a lot of the debris was only found after the Australian search had finished. So the Australian experts were the ones that did the reverse drift. They looked at the debris, and they worked out, by looking at the tides and the ocean flows, mm-hmm. were able to work out where this would have been 2 years previously or 3 years previously. They then looked at the various, was it crumpled, was it broken, had it been ripped off, and were able to extrapolate probably how the plane came out of the sky. It is extrapolation. There are no facts involved here. Let's be blunt about this. Everybody has a view. I'll give you an example, Jeremy. The recent Australian program, 60 Minutes, did a major documentary on this, where the conclusion was that there was somebody at the controls when the plane went into the water. Now, that is counter to everything that the authorities have said had happened.
What about the debris? How much has been found, and how sure are authorities that it came from this plane?
Oh, they're, in some cases, they're absolutely sure. I mean, there's no question. They have found pieces of debris, the flaperon, for example, various pieces of the fuselage that had numbers on it that could only have come from MH370. So you've got those that are certainly from MH370. And then you've got those pieces that are almost certainly. You know, it merely means there was no stamp, no individual unique identifying number. But it was a part of a 777 that was found on the other side of the Indian Ocean, and nobody has reported a part missing besides MH370. So the short and long of it is, there is plenty of debris from MH370 that they can now extrapolate roughly where it went down. But the actual topography of the ocean bed, the depth of water, the size and scale involved, and crucially, we still do not know exactly what happened when the plane ran out of fuel. It makes 100 miles in one direction or 100 miles in another direction difference.
And there are a lot of theories out there about what happened. We've talked about them over the years, but I want to go through a few of them. I mean, one idea is that someone took the plane down on purpose. We heard that theory right after the crash in March of 2014 from former pilot Mark Weiss. Let's listen.
Did somebody come into the cockpit? Did somebody who was in the cockpit try to wrestle that airplane away from the pilots? Did one of the pilots have a meltdown? Certainly, there seems to have been enough time for word to have gotten out from the cockpit, if word had wanted to be gotten out.
What about that, Richard Quest, the idea that this plane was taken down on purpose?
I mean, could it? Yes. Did it? I don't know. That theory of what I put in the nefarious, I put that in the nefarious bucket. Was it a terrorist? Did somebody break in? Was the plane hijacked? There's no evidence of this. There's nobody's claim to responsibility. There have been the only people who shouldn't have been on that plane were two asylum seekers from Iran. Then you come to the pilot. Was it Zahiri? Well, he had practiced flying on his own private simulator down towards the Indian Ocean. He was supposedly having marital problems. But there's no evidence. Does it look likely? Possibly. Somebody clearly did switch off the transponder, which identifies the aircraft. Somebody did disable the ACARS, which is a communication system. And somebody did fly the plane up the Straits of Malacca, around the tip of Indonesia, and set it on a course down towards the southern Indian Ocean. But we do not know whether it was by accident or by design. And in the court of public opinion, we cannot convict the pilot until we have a bit more than we've got at the moment.
But when you put it the way you just did, it does sound like it was by design.
Oh, you're wonderful, Jeremy. You're going down. You're going down. There's no smoke without fire argument, and I can certainly see the attraction of it. But if you had said that an MD-11 was going to come out the sky because of the in-flight entertainment system setting on fire above the cockpit, you'd have said that's never going to happen. But it did with Swiss. Mm-hmm. If you'd said that a British Airways 777 was going to crash land at Heathrow because of ice in the fuel system, you'd have said, well, highly unlikely. But it did. Having covered airline and aviation incidents for the best part of three decades, I know that the final result is usually something that you've never even thought of, or possibly not likely. In this case, I caution, and we don't know where the plane is. We know it is somewhere off the western coast of Australia in the southern Indian Ocean, where it's tens of thousands of feet deep, but nobody knows exactly where.
So I guess I shouldn't even ask you this next one, but there are people who thought that the plane actually landed somewhere. This is Jeff Wise, a former aviation analyst for CNN, who looked at that in 2015.
The data that remains that I think is pretty much incorruptible by itself gives a pretty good idea of where the plane went, and it's hard to arrive at any place other than Kazakhstan.
Seems like that theory is not being taken seriously anymore.
Jeff Wise, dear chap, made a very good name for himself with that theory in his article, which has been widely debunked, and even he now accepts that that is not the case at all. He was talking earlier on when it looked like there were two possibilities of the northern corridor or the southern corridor. We're long past that. But you have got real hard evidence that the plane came out of the sky tragically in the water. I'll tell you what's really interesting is whether the new government in Kuala Lumpur of Mahathir Mohamad, whether the new government there will choose to take this up as a cause, as indeed the previous government seemed to forget about it, or will they also let it drift? If the new government in Malaysia believes that there is political mileage in making trouble for the previous government, it's entirely possible that they will reveal all the things that we don't know, such as what did happen on the night, What did the Malaysian Air Force see? Why didn't they scramble planes? How was a plane able to fly right across the country? What are the true private secret documents the Malaysian government has that they've never revealed about what happened on the night?
Richard Quest, most of the time with airplane crashes, once they figure out what did happen, there are changes made to either aircraft or to procedures on board to try to prevent that same thing from happening again. In this case, we don't yet know what happened. Has anything changed across the board for airlines?
Oh, absolutely. The biggest change. It took the international authorities some time, but the airlines did it themselves, was tracking of aircraft. Most viewers and listeners don't realize that once planes go oceanic, there's no radar. They are tracked either by timing, so you know what time it goes out over the ocean, and therefore you just track it backwards or forwards across the ocean, or by satellite. It registers with a satellite. It sends its position. And the big change was, whereas sometimes airlines didn't track or got information, say, every 15 minutes, every 10 minutes, now in many cases the airlines are down at 3 minutes, 1 minute, or 30 seconds. The machines are constantly sending out signals. This is where I am. This is where I am. This is how much fuel. This is what's happening. This is the speed. And the other thing that's interesting is systems are designed now so that if the plane deviates substantially from its route plan and expected course, then it will set off an alarm back at base. So yes, real change has taken place. It should have happened before, but there's never the wrong time to do the right thing.
Do you think we'll ever know what happened to MH370? Do you think this is really the end of the search?
No, I think it's the end of the search for now. But Amelia Earhart, the Titanic, they found the Titanic 70-odd years after the thing went down. We have a thirst of knowledge that we need to know. And nowhere is that more important in the world of aviation. Oh, I'm familiar with those execs and those people who say, we know what happened, the pilot did it. Let me tell you now, Jeremy, we do not know what happened.
That's Richard Quest of CNN. He's the author of the book, The Vanishing of Flight MH370, which vanished more than 4 years ago now, and they've just ended the search for it, the latest search. Richard, thanks as always.
Thank you.
This podcast and following message are sponsored by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? Every business needs great people and a way to find them. Something more than posting your job online and just praying for the right people to see it. ZipRecruiter revolutionized hiring. Their technology finds great candidates for you. It learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right experience, and invites them to apply to your job. Right now, listeners can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/here. That's /HERE. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Planet Money tip number 17. A great analogy doesn't have to make sense.
Busier than a one-legged bobcat covering up his own crap on a frozen pond.
Didn't you just make that up?
Well, yeah.
Planet Money, a poetic podcast about the economy.
A move today by the Supreme Court could have big implications for abortion access in Arkansas. The court rejected a challenge from Planned Parenthood to a controversial Arkansas law that restricts access to abortions induced by medication. Today's decision paves the way for the law to go into effect in July, and it is a blow to abortion rights advocates. Joining us with more on this is Emily Bazelon, staff writer at the New York Times Magazine and a fellow at Yale Law School. Emily, first tell us about this Arkansas law and how it ended up in court.
This is a law that concerns medication abortions. So we're talking about women being able to use pills to induce an abortion in the first trimester. And it's a law enacted in 2015 that requires healthcare providers that do the procedure to contract with a doctor who has admitting privileges at a hospital in Arkansas. And if that sounds kind of confusing, it is. It's the kind of red tape that's designed to prevent medication abortions from taking place. And that's what the women who brought this lawsuit are complaining about.
And the Supreme Court decided not to take up this case. So what does that mean for access to abortion in Arkansas?
Well, Arkansas has 3 abortion clinics, and 2 of them offer medication abortions. And so this ruling, if it goes into effect, is going to cause those 2 clinics to close, leaving women in Arkansas with only 1 clinic in the state and a long drive. We're talking, you know, 300 or 400 mile drive to get abortions, depending on where they live. And only surgical abortions will be available in Arkansas. A lot of women prefer taking these pills as opposed to having a surgical procedure.
Does it give us a better sense of where the Supreme Court stands on abortion right now?
You know, it's kind of confusing. A couple years ago, the Supreme Court struck down a similar law in Texas. And at that point, the court said, look, you know, we don't allow laws to create what's called an undue burden on the constitutional right to abortion. And Texas had a law that did a lot of wrapping abortion in red tape as well. And the court said, we don't see any real health benefit to women here. We see the state kind of cynically trying to prevent abortions from occurring and from prevent women from accessing this right. And so by leaving in place this Arkansas law, the court is signaling to other judges around the country, hey, maybe we didn't really mean it the first time around. You can just kind of try to push a lot here and give states more more leeway to enact these laws than the earlier decision would seem to allow for.
Just briefly, a separate case today, the court ruled 8-1 that police cannot search the area around a private home without a warrant. What was this about?
This is a case in which the police saw a photograph on Facebook of a motorcycle they thought was stolen, and it was parked in a driveway. So they went to the guy's house. They picked up the tarp that was covering the motorcycle. It looked like the photo on Facebook. They arrested the person who owned the house. And the question here is whether the police could do this kind of search without a warrant, because it was in the proximity of someone's house, in the driveway. That's an area where usually you have a protection against a warrantless search under the Fourth Amendment. So that was what was at issue here.
And by the way, in this case, Ferris Bueller's Day Off came up.
Yes, it did. One of the ways in which the lawyers, the civil rights advocates, were trying to argue that the cops went too far was invoking that amazing image from the movie. Do you remember? There's a Ferrari
right,
in the
garage.
Right. Exactly. And so the lawyers were saying, look, the police should have to get a warrant to search that kind of a structure. Yeah. And that's why we were talking about Ferris Bueller.
It's Emily Bazelon. Emily, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
If President Donald Trump's meeting with North Korea's Kim Jong-un goes ahead, what kind of relationship might the two men have, and what effect would that have on the relations between their two nations? Well, there are examples in very recent history about how things can get personal, even ugly. Consider what happened to Michael McFaul, former U.S. ambassador to Russia. In 2012, as Vladimir Putin was running for election in Russia, McFaul found himself the victim of a viral video that accused him of being a pedophile. And to this day, searches for McFaul's name and the word pedophile turn up millions of hits on Russian search engines. That's just one of the stories McFaul tells in his new political memoir, From Cold War to Hot Peace, An American Ambassador in Putin's Russia. I spoke with Michael McFaul recently, and I asked him if he believed that Vladimir Putin was behind the video.
Well, we have no way of knowing, and that's the way the Putin regime works. They always use cutouts. It's never directly from the Kremlin. Same way in 2016, by the way, the things that they've done. So I don't assume that it was him. But was there a broad campaign against me personally, against President Obama himself, where they described him as being a supporter of ISIS during the same time? That was crystal clear. And those television stations, primary television, because that's where Russians get their media from, they are all controlled by the Kremlin. And it was designed for a purpose. It wasn't just something personal about me. It was designed for a purpose because at that time, there were big demonstrations against Putin and his regime. And so they needed to mobilize their base against the West. They pulled out a kind of old Cold War narrative that the West was out to get them. And they blamed us, America, Obama, and me, for supporting, allegedly, we weren't, but for supporting the Democratic opposition rallying against Putin.
So this is 2012. Obviously, you know, 2016 and Russian meddling in the U.S. election is what immediately comes to mind.
It should.
But how did the Obama administration How did you as ambassador respond in 2012? I mean, to this viral video?
Well, it's hard. And I'm glad we're talking about it because now we're talking about fake news and disinformation. And many Americans have just become aware of this phenomenon. But several years ago, of course, we were experiencing it directly. And it's difficult. What do? You get on Twitter and say, I'm not a pedophile? That doesn't work too well. Then some people start arguing with you. You know, my wife didn't even want me to put this story in the book, just so you know, because she thinks once you say that, suddenly people are thinking in different ways about you. And that's how disinformation works. And remember, Putin's not trying to win the argument about anything. He's just trying to make a mess about the truth and falsehoods. And that's how disinformation works. And it worked, I think, tragically, successfully against our administration.
Well, so I'm curious what you think about this, because I imagine that critics of the Obama administration would say that, first of all, in 2016, the administration's response to what they knew at the time about Russian meddling wasn't robust enough.
Yes.
Sounds like, I mean, if you say it was hard and you didn't really know what to do in 2012, that it also wasn't robust enough. I mean, was this basically, were there multiple times, before 2016 where the United States failed to push back against Vladimir Putin on these things?
Yes, I think there was.
Why?
Well, a couple of reasons. And remember, I'd left the government in 2014, but all my friends are still at the White House through 2016. And I would say a couple of things. One, this was new in American electoral politics. These were instruments of power that we'd seen in Russia and in countries near Russia, but we'd never seen it inside our own country. Number two, as they would tell you if they were here with you, my White House friends, they didn't want to weigh in because they were afraid of being accused of helping Secretary Clinton. That was a hard call. I want to make sure everybody understands for me that was a hard call. But I write about it in my book. I think they should have done more, particularly on this day, October 7th, 2016. They put out their statement. And I was at the White House before I went to Moscow. I know how you roll out a statement if you want to get it attention. You have it come out of the White House. You have a press conference about it.
But you don't know that an Access Hollywood tape is going to break.
Well, we didn't know that. That was a problem for them. But they rolled it slow. They didn't do that kind of thing. I think that was a mistake. And then don't forget, there are other actors involved here, Facebook, Twitter. They are also seeing this stuff for the first time, not fully understanding it and not fully understanding how to deal with it. And I deal with those companies quite a bit right now. I think they now see that it's no longer sufficient to say that we don't have an editorial policy. Algorithms are editorial policy. But back then it was brand new and they were just trying to figure it out in real time. Mm. And so they were slow to react.
So let me just go back to the 2012 moment again. And in fact, what I want to do is actually go back even further, because it was just a couple of years before that, though, that, you know, there was the famous reset with
yes.
U.S.-Russia relations. You're the architect of that
yes.
reset. I mean, it was, what, 3 or 4 years
exactly.
in that how did things change so quickly?
Well, I am the architect of that, and that word is mine for better or for ill. And we had a fantastic run with the Russians. I'm glad you reminded your listeners. There was a period of cooperation with President Medvedev, not President Putin, and we got the START Treaty done, bringing down by 30% the number of nuclear weapons allowed in the world. Sanctions on Iran that led to the Iran deal, which I think is a great deal. New supply routes to Afghanistan, Russian WTO. And back then, not just to ancient history, but 5 years ago, 6 years ago, the majority of Russians has a positive view of us and vice versa. It's a complicated story. That's why I wrote the book, to explain it. But the punchline is two things happened. One, Putin comes back into power, and he has a different view about us. He sees us more in zero-sum terms, whereas Medvedev thought about win-win outcomes in cooperating with us. But then, two, back to when I arrived, demonstrations were against Putin, and he needed a new argument to win re-election. And so he made us the enemy again. And as you said, poster child, I just happened to arrive right in that mess. And one of his advisors said to me, you know, remember, I've been living in and out of that country for 30 years. I got a lot of friends in the government. And one of them, a Kremlin person, said, you know, Mike, don't take anything personal. We're just going to use you for this election, and then we're going to get back to normal. And I was like, pedophile. I'm going to take that personal. I'm sorry. But it turned out we didn't get back to normal because he needed to keep that mobilization against us.
Well, I want to play a piece of tape for you here because, of course, there's considerable disagreement about whether or not the Obama reset was effective. This is Stephen Cohen, professor emeritus of Russian studies at NYU, and he says that during the reset, the U.S. was asking Russia for significant concessions, but really the U.S. wasn't offering much in return. So let's listen.
This was called selective cooperation. And best I understand this expression, Professor McFaul has used it, so has Mrs. Clinton and others. Selective cooperation means we get, they give. And we pretend it's diplomatic cooperation.
What do you say?
Well, two things. Back then, it was not selective cooperation. That comes when Putin comes in. We were cooperating on everything. We were cooperating on airspace and civil society. We even had, we had 22 working groups with the Russians back at the height of the reset. But number two, with all my respect for Professor Cohen's academic work, diplomacy is not about concessions. Nobody ever does anybody any favors in international diplomacy, especially not with the Russians. And so the idea that we're going to give them concessions and they're going to give us, it doesn't work that way. It has to be where both sides think that they're better off to sign this deal. Medvedev didn't sign the START Treaty as a concession to America. He signed it because he thought it was in Russia's national interest. He didn't sign up for sanctions on Iran as a gift to his buddy Barak. He did it because he thought it was in Russia's national interest.
And Ambassador McFaul, the phrase in the title of your book, Cold War to Hot Peace, what specifically do you mean by that?
Yeah, I use that phrase on purpose to echo elements of the Cold War, because there are things that are new, but it's not Cold War 2.0, because some things are different. Cyber is new. That's a totally new world that we did not encounter in the Cold War. Annexation. We thought annexation was done. In the Cold War, there was not annexation. Now we're back to that. And in particular, Putin is willing to use his power in a much more aggressive way than the last Cold War leaders. That makes it a very dangerous world.
Ambassador Michael McFaul is the former U.S. ambassador to Russia under President Obama. His new book is From Cold War to Hot Peace, An American Ambassador in Putin's Russia.
The deadline is tomorrow for city officials in Philadelphia who have vowed to shut down two homeless encampments for people addicted to drugs. Under a new pilot program, outreach workers are trying to place each person living under neighborhood bridges into a special shelter or treatment program. But some fear the plan could scatter homeless drug users around the neighborhood. WHYY contributor Joel Wolfram reports.
A young man named John is sitting on a street corner down the block from a railroad bridge where people pitch tents along busy Kensington Avenue. He has a weary look on his face, a red gash on his forehead, and a harrowing story.
Some dude hit me in a truck in my tent. Believe it or not, yeah, I just got my head.
John shows me five staples in his scalp where he got hit. But his girlfriend got the worst of it. The two of them were together inside the tent, talking about how to get to a clinic where she was starting addiction treatment.
My girlfriend was closer to the street, so as soon as the impact happened, her upper body flung across, like, kind of my lap, and then the truck hit me in the shoulder and the head, and then he backed up, but I guess one of the tires had ran over her upper leg area, and that caused the fracture.
He says her pelvis was broken in four places. John is facing unresolved criminal charges, so he doesn't want to give his full name. He says he's been homeless for 3 months, and recently stopped using heroin and started treatment at a methadone clinic. The clinic has been trying to find him housing, but with his tent destroyed, he's not sure where he'll end up now.
Not having the best fortune or luck lately, but hopefully things will change.
By the end of May, all of the other people living under this bridge on Kensington Avenue and another one half a mile away on Tulip Street will also have to move. The two encampments combined are home to about 90 people, and the city is doing intensive outreach to get each of them off the street and into housing and treatment programs. Under the bridge, idling garbage trucks gobble up litter while Nicole Bixler chats with encampment residents. She's a social worker who comes here on her own time to give them food, toiletries, and rides to treatment. Other outreach teams working for the city will offer some shelter in a new 40-bed respite nearby, even if they're not ready or able to start treatment. But Bixler doesn't think the city's plan will work.
What I predict is going to happen, this bridge will be cleaned out, Tulip will be cleaned out, they'll go to the other bridges, they'll go in abandoned buildings, the community will be broken up and they'll die alone and no one will know until we smell them in the summertime, because that's a reality.
She also hears echoes of last year's closure of the camp at the Conrail Tracks, another place where drug users gathered to inject heroin. The city offered services to those who were displaced, but most refused the help. People caught up in opioid addiction created these new encampments last fall. The city now counts about 180 people living under four bridges. But city officials say they've learned lessons from the Conrail closure. They're starting with two of the encampments first to see how things go, rather than tackling them all at once. Eva Gladstein is Deputy Managing Director of Philadelphia's Health and Human Services.
What's different now is that we have organized resources that we believe are going to be equal to the need.
Gladstein says the city is making enough shelter beds available for the 90 people living under the two bridges, and that it's removing barriers to treatment, like requiring people to have IDs to enroll. The city is working with the local organization Prevention Point to conduct outreach and operate the new respite, which will serve as a navigation center for people getting services. Executive Director Jose Benitez says so far the city is backing up its promises.
There's been very little denial of the treatment that people are requesting at this particular point. No denials, actually.
Still, Benitez says he's not sure whether Philadelphia can offer enough beds to meet the demand at the two encampments.
I don't know that yet. I think we're going to learn that in this process.
But some advocates are questioning whether now is the right time to clear the camps. The city announced months ago that it was pursuing supervised injection facilities to slow the rising tide of overdose deaths. The city says they would also be a place where people struggling with addiction on the streets could access treatment and housing. Some supporters of the controversial site say it would be better to have a new way to engage drug users before people at the Kensington encampments are dispersed. But many neighbors who live nearby are relieved that the city is finally taking action. Gloria Cartagena is the president of the local neighborhood association, Somerset Neighbors for Better Living.
It's like it's about time. That's what we all say. And we can't have this around here. Needles and trash piling up everywhere.
Cartagena's group has been pressing the city since last fall to get drug users off the streets and out of view of neighborhood children.
I usually hear it at this time.
Back at the Kensington Avenue Bridge, Salvatore Gonzalez Jr. is considering his options. Heroin addiction brought the 33-year-old here a few months ago, and he's still using. Gonzalez says Prevention Point is working to get him and his fiancée into a shelter and eventually more permanent housing. But he's not sure what his next move will be.
Whether good or bad, I mean, we're going to be forced to take another step. So that is a good thing. All the way around the board is a good thing.
The city has given Gonzalez and everyone else living under the bridge a May 30th deadline to take that next step. For Here and Now, I'm Joel Wolfram.
I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.